This audio is a recording of a RAG meeting on new media and social media held June 14, 2010 in Shrewsbury. It looks at the uses and dangers of new media and the possibilities for positive change and radical democracy via the internet.
Hi everybody, my name is Emma, I'm a member of RAG, and I am the one who conceived of this discussion. I think it's really going to be a really great discussion. I'm so glad every I invited to come and speak today has been able to come. So to start off, I'm just going to give a little bit of, I suppose, an introduction to my own ideas and sort of the discussion, the popular discussion around new media at the moment regarding privacy and that. I don't know how many of you saw the photograph that was used to advertise this event. It's a picture of two people sitting together on a toilet with a neon light behind them reading, "We live in public." This photo was taken from the cover of a newly released movie called We Live in Public, which is a documentary about one of the first and little heard of internet pioneers, entrepreneurs and media artists, Josh Harris, aka the Warhol of the web. When he made a substantial buck on the dot-com explosion, in opposition to the other dot-com millionaires, Harris spent his money on a sociological art experiment called Quiet. And here I'm taking from the movie's website. Quiet took place in an underground bunker in New York City, where over 100 people lived together on camera for 30 days at the turn of the millennium. With Quiet, Harris proved how willingly we trade our privacy for the connection and recognition we all deeply desire. But with every, what the website calls, technological advancement, but what I would call communication and social phenomena, such as MySpace, Facebook and Twitter, this experience of recognition and connection becomes more elusive and sometimes sinister. In an article published on the website Gizmodo, Dan Yoder gives 10 arguments on why we should quit Facebook. Yoder mostly discusses the privacy issues regarding Facebook and their seemingly sneaky ways of going about accessing information on its customers and then making that information public. He says, Facebook is clearly determined to add every feature of every competing social network in an attempt to take over the web. I often hear people talking about Facebook as though they were some sort of monopoly or public trust. Well, they aren't. They owe us nothing. They can do whatever they want within the bounds of the law. And keep in mind, even those criteria are pretty murky when it comes to social networking. But that doesn't mean we have to actually put up with them. In an article entitled Too Much Information, What Google and Facebook Know About You, recently published in the Irish Times Weekend Review, Carolyn Lillington commented on the fact that whereas once upon a time, online you could be anyone you wished, or you could be you, identity was fluid and vague. Now it's quite the opposite. In fact, issues of privacy and control, ownership and public accessibility of personal information has become one of the primary concerns regarding social networking sites, in particular Facebook. Lillington asks if these concerns are valid. Are the problems often discussed regarding Facebook and its policies actually something to worry about? I wasn't sure until I read that the introduction of compulsory identification cards to secondary school newcomers in the UK was conceived via Facebook marketing information. Another concern of mine is how, although the new technology such as cameras are becoming more and more accessible in the democratic sense, our etiquette in using these devices is lagging behind. And as I discover more and more photos of myself posted on the internet, without me being informed, I wonder if the problems regarding new media stretch to ones regarding bodily integrity and or exploitation. So, I'd like to introduce our speakers, all of whom are very interested in this topic and are working and experimenting with issues of identity, the body, new media and social networking sites and blogging in particular. Angela, is it Nagel?
Yeah.
Nagel, has an English degree and an MA in Popular Literature from TCD. She has just started working as a researcher for a TV documentary production company called Kashmir Media. She has worked as a script reader and script editor for film companies Element and Samson Films, and has been writing for Film Ireland magazine and website as a film reviewer and feature writer. She has also written more recently for James Redman's website Soundtracks for Them, primarily doing feminist book reviews. She is interested in writing more about new media, particularly from a feminist angle, and what she is currently preparing for a media conference that is a few months down the line. Caroline Campbell is a filmmaker and lawyer who specialises in digital cultures. She has been on the programming committee of the Darklight Festival since its inception, where she has programmed events on open source and open culture, social media and network cultures. She holds an MA in Art in the Contemporary World from NCAD. Current research interests in network cultures include the post-workerist writings on immaterial labour. Fionn Kidney, to the left of Caroline, has spent his early career with one of Ireland's top creative agencies, including a year as director of digital, during which he laid the foundations for Stratagem to win Best Digital Direct Campaign in 2008 on Post DMA Awards. Since then, he has divided his time between film, photography and consultancy work and concentrated on small-scale creative projects. Fionn has chaired seminars for both the Darklight Festival and the EU Commission relating to online film, and his interests in online relate principally to the projection and perception of identity. And I saw Fionn facilitate and present a seminar on democracy and dialogue in relation to new media as a form of radical democracy and as a way to utilise radical democracy last August. Andrew Flood, to the left of Fionn, is a Dublin anarchist who has been using the internet for organising since before the web came into existence. Today he is totally addicted to Facebook and finding ways to make social networking a powerful tool for building struggles in the real world. And finally, Vanessa Monaghan is a mature student studying multimedia who returned to college after working in the music industry, which she still dabbles in. She started blogging for a college assignment and was most recently a finalist in the Student Media Awards for Blog of the Year 2010. She loves the internet, loves Twitter, and loves the freedom that it gives people, especially artists trying to get their art, whether it be music, writing, painting, out to a global audience. She loves the informality of Twitter and the ability to converse with people you may never meet with. One of the things she really dislikes about Facebook is how it seems to turn some people's lives completely into the virtual world. They don't seem to function or even have a real world. She gets asked a lot what her blog is about and says, why does it have to be about anything? My blog is a personal blog, probably an extension of diary writing. It's about my radio shows, college, video photography. I don't want to spend all my day writing about politics. I've made it enjoyable for myself, so I keep doing it. She's finding that blogging is a good way to show people that what she's doing now and what she's capable of when she leaves college. So big round for our speakers. So I'll ask Andrew?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah?
Okay, I wasn't too sure how to approach this talk. I reckon when to create a fan page rather than a group on Facebook might be a little bit dull. So instead I'm going to tell some stories that I think illustrate both the areas of potential concern that people have around new media. And I should say I'm pretty much approaching this purely from the point of view of political activism and the sort of concerns between security and privacy that have pretty much always been part of political activism. So the first story I'm going to tell starts in 1917, so it's all a bit pre-new media. July 1917 in Petrograd, there's a failed rising. And in the aftermath of this, a number of the exiled Bolshevik leaders return to the city. Now, what's interesting for us in this is that Lenin, when he returns, rather than sneaking across the border, which is what most people were doing, chose to make a big pre-announced arrival in the Finland station, which is one of the main stations in Petrograd, and this was turned into a big party rally. I missed the session, so the idea is not mine, but at the London Anarchist Book Fair a couple of years back, Ian Bone said that if this had been anarchist, the train would have pulled into the station, and at the front of it there'd been a little note stuck to it that would have read something along the lines of, for more information, contact P.O. Box 1528. You know, anarchists tend to be very kind of
clandestine and underground a lot of the times, not just with new media stuff, but with old media stuff as well, and arguments about who should talk to the media and when, or whether or not we should at all, have been raging for much longer, really, than any of this new media stuff has been around. And there's a contradiction for revolutionaries between visible activity and personal security. And by security, I think you can mean everything from being invisible to the state to being invisible to employers and fascists. Back in the 1970s, there were organisations like the Economic League in Britain, which spied on left-wing organisations, and actually pretty crudely, one of the things they used to do was just buy the various newspapers and copy down the names of the people who'd written the articles, and then they sold these on to major employers, essentially to be used as blacklists so they'd know who not to employ, who the troublemakers were. These services were pretty expensive, you know, the likes of Ford or whatever could afford them. But today, any employer with a computer connection can pretty much achieve the same thing in seconds through something like Google. You know, if you're in the practice of putting your own name in your articles, they go online, they'll pretty much turn up immediately. Now, this has consequences. Back in 1992, I was one of a group of anarchists who founded, which was, I'm pretty certain, the first online anarchist archive of texts, which was called Spunk Press. It was actually from a Swedish thing. This used a file retrieval system called Gopher. The web did exist at that point, but it was not until 1993 it really took off, so it's kind of pre-web. The internet at the time was a very obscure place. It was the hangout solely of programmers and other associated geeks. So really, although what you put up was publicly accessible, and you kind of knew that, very few people actually thought about this because nobody looked at the bloody thing. So many of us posted from work email addresses, and in fact, there wasn't really all the free email addresses you can get at the moment. Your work email address tended to be the one you had. And our footers would include our full names and our work telephone numbers and all that sort of stuff. Now, this bit us in the ass quite quickly. When the Sunday Times ran, well, it was probably one of the first internet scare stories, I'd say back in late 93 or early 1994, which painted Spunk Press as some sort of terrorist organisation, bringing together a crazy coalition that ran all the way from ETA to loyalist paramilitaries in Ireland. It had pretty serious consequences for one of the editors who lived and worked in Britain, because they not only put his name up, they also made a big deal out of the fact of which company he was working for, named the company, almost resulted in him in getting sacked, didn't in the end. The only really new aspect to that was that it was a new media publication, if you like. It was an online thing. Right-wing press targeting political activists wasn't new then. It's been going on probably as long as publishing has. The difference is with new media, the collection of information for a smear article on someone is very much easier than it used to be, particularly via Facebook, for instance. The other thing about personal security is it can change from one stage of your life to another. You don't necessarily expect that. I moved to Canada around 4 years back for what turned out to be a brief period, and in doing so moved from a situation where I had a full-time job and citizenship, and thus was not that worried about being out there, to one where I'd neither, and would be regularly crossing one of the world's most paranoid borders, i.e. going in and out of the United States. I was living on more or less on the US border. And actually in this period, a regular story in Canadian news was US border guards who'd get a bit suspicious about somebody and put them into Google and dig something up. And the most famous case I remember was there was some academic who border guard decided he didn't like, found an academic paper where he admitted taking LSD in the 60s and refused him entry on those grounds. That became kind of a big story in the media. Now, if you Google my name, you get a lot of stuff because I've been online so long. And in fact, one of the first results of that period was a picture of me with a line of masked and armed Zapatistas standing immediately behind me. So you can imagine if you're going into the US, particularly on a relatively obscure border crossing, you know, border guard pulls that up, doesn't really know any of the context of it. It could be a little bit problematical. There wasn't much I could do in terms of removing all that stuff that was up there. I did actually have control over that particular page, and I'll talk about it in a second, but otherwise, like, I had thousands of articles scattered all over the place that people had republished on different sites. And if you look hard enough, you'll even find some of the old emails from the 1990s with my work address in it and all the rest. So the actual solution I came up with on that occasion was to invent another Andrew Flood, who had written all that stuff. And I even provided a picture of him. So if you Google that page now, you'll discover I used the old work email address as well. And I found a picture of Nestor Makhno as a young guy in a very kind of Depeche Mode style pose. You know, he's kind of got the hand on the chin, long coat, looking kind of wistfully into the future. And I stuck that one up. So the basic idea was, if you ran into that curious border guard and he Googled you and kind of spotted the Andrew Flood anarchist thing, then found this page that had a photograph of the guy, and it wasn't me or anyone who looked like me, also with a different middle initial. So that gets me to Facebook. What initially led me to Facebook was the ability to put up the old dodgy photos of me without having to worry about random border guards therefore seeing them. Now, what's not the, this isn't the same thing at all as thinking that content is not available to the various secret police forces, bored Facebook employees, and even journalists and the like who are smart enough to get around often ineffective security settings. That's even when they're not changing them every 5 minutes. Anyone, for instance, can download every image in a friend-of-friend set of images if you happen to see one of them. So if you tag somebody in one of those, they see it. You can get programs that will then strip every picture out of that particular album. And I know at least one journalist who sort of makes a living out of doing exactly that sort of thing. Facebook is pretty much set up to be a stalker's heaven in general. Although Facebook logs how often you look at someone's profile, it doesn't provide this information to you, and it promises not to provide it to anyone else. Of course, whether or not they're actually capable of fulfilling that promise is another thing. It's pretty much designed to allow you to give away all sorts of personal information on an ongoing basis to people who you may well only vaguely know, and if you're not careful with your settings, to people you may not know at all. It's not very surprising people find this alarming. But they also get pulled into the implicit exchange of details involved. Basically, you swap someone checking out your drunken party pics from holidays 2 years back for your ability to surf theirs. And kind of the dirty secret of Facebook is that's pretty much what everybody's doing on it. Unless they choose to like or comment on a photo, you don't even know they've been there. And if they do, either you may well find it quite creepy that they've been looking in the first place. Of course, as any of you who are friends of mine on Facebook will know, I pretty much use it incessantly. I'm always posting photographs and updates, and you can sort of track wherever I am at a given moment through it. The thing to understand when you're using Facebook for a political tool, though, is that even if you call yourself Anne Anonymous or Michael Bakunin, you're making a similar sort of compromise. In the first season of The Wire, anybody not seen The Wire yet? Oh, nobody's admitting it. Good. In the first season of The Wire, the cops spend a considerable period of time trying to construct a map of the drug dealer network based on who was calling who. And if you think about it, if you're a political cop investigating us, you can get all that information in seconds off your Facebook friend list. I post a lot of protest pictures, as people know. I tend to go along to demonstrations, take a load of pictures, post them, and people happily trawl through them, tagging each other, even from photos years ago. One of the weird things that's been going on recently is lots of people I don't know finding my old anti-war photos from 2003 and tagging each other in it, and you get a little thing that actually says, will you allow them to do this? And it's kind of, wow, who the hell's going through it now? There was a cool app on Facebook called Nexus that you could run it, and it looked at your friend list and gave you a kind of linked node map of who was connected to who. It's a very useful kind of warning in those terms. When I ran it on my account, as it produced three very distinct clusters. One was activists in Ireland, one was old friends of mine in Ireland, and the third one was activists in North America, and that's from the time I spent there and travelling around there. And also you could see who the key connecting people were between each cluster, like who knew who in each network and who was probably important in terms of communication. It vanished 18 months back, and I rather suspect the authors got hired by the NSA or something similar. And in terms of how long it would have taken for the special branch in this country to construct an activist map a decade ago that would have involved going around photographing people, following them around, seeing who they were talking to, probably bugging their phones, then putting all that information up on a big board, sort of process you see in The Wire, it's certainly the sort of stuff they used to do. Nowadays, you can pretty much do that in seconds through Facebook. And what's even better about it is not only is it instantly accessible, we're constantly updating it so they can really keep track of stuff. I think to keep that in context, though, the most dangerous thing when it comes to personal or collective security is not really, in fact, what you choose to make public or semi-public. There's a decision in that process. Presumably people think about it at least a little bit, although arguably they don't think about it enough. The more dangerous thing is when you think you're doing something in secret, but in reality it's visible to those with the power to have a look. And those are the circumstances in which people say something they shouldn't say, or they think they're actually safe and they're not safe. And really, I would say the only safe way to treat the internet in general, and Facebook in particular, is to assume that everything you post is going to be visible to anyone willing to try hard enough, and will certainly be automatically visible to whoever your local political police force is. So probably at this stage, everybody's ready to run home and delete their Facebook profiles, and they're probably also wondering, how come I haven't? Which is where we started with that story about the Finland station, Lenin's arrival, and the safe alternative of, for more information, contact PO Box 1528. We need to look at the actual risks and balance those against the actual gains. So the gains in terms of Facebook is it keeps me in constant contact with probably about 500 anarchists around the world and another 200 or so odd old friends or family who managed to mess up that neat activist map a bit for the branch. It includes at least one serving member of the US military, so they probably get all sorts of weird looks. Their profile news posts give me a constant alternative picture of what is happening in the world. The Facebook feed is now where I tend to find out about stuff, really. And it's selected and indeed filtered for me by hundreds of people with whom I've quite a lot in common. In terms of real-world organising in Ireland, Facebook events have been a very powerful way to spread news of events. I think we had about 1,200 people signing up for the Anarchist Book Fair page, for instance, and to recruit from those events after they've passed. The aftermath of the anti-capitalist blocs, the WSM account, which I run, expanded by a good 150 people who are living in Dublin, all of whom are now in ongoing contact with us. And if you're thinking about organisation and bringing people together, being able to contact people in the future, these are far from insignificant things. They're actually very important. The other more important, though, is that while you can choose to escape Facebook, it's actually just the most visible manifestation of just how easy it is to track, identify, and record people these days. We're aware of Facebook because we can very much see the process. They don't show us all the process. There's quite a lot happening behind curtains, but in fact, compared to a lot of other things, you can see it. Gmail, for instance, is collecting pretty much the same sort of information about you, but until the cock-up that was the release of Buzz a few months back, very few people realised that. And it's really only with Buzz that a lot of people go, oh, hang on, this is kind of weird, how do they know all this shit?
And you can
explain that? So Buzz was kind of Gmail's attempt at, or Google's attempt at launching something a bit like a social networking thing, and the... When they did it, they did this really dumb thing of if you said yes, you wanted to sign up to it, it automatically added the, I think it was the 20 people you emailed most often as your friends, right? Now, that sounds kind of harmless unless, say, well, give a non-political example, if you're having an affair with somebody and they turn up as one of those 20 people. Or if you're working in a company and you're leaking secrets to some other company, they turn up as one of those 20. So, you know, there's a whole load of, even for, you know, people who aren't involved in political activity or things that are going, oh, wait a second, what the hell did you just do there? Really, to be completely secure online, you'd have to never use a computer at work or at home, constantly change which internet cafe you used for your carefully encrypted emails, and they need to be sent just to people who were very, very sure were constantly taking similar precautions. So essentially, the internet is not secure, and never really has been, and probably never will be. There are particular things you can do if you really do need to have encrypted communications with other people, but looking at it as being considerably less secure than a telephone is really the wise way to approach it. Even there, though, there's no escape. Even staying off the internet, there's an escape. I was part of a conversation a while back. We were talking about riots in the 1980s, and if you happened to be involved in a riot, if you managed to walk away at the end of the night, you could be pretty sure that was it. Today, not only are there cameras everywhere, CCTV, fit teams, just everybody taking pictures. I wandered down to spectate at the Love Ulster riot in the city centre there a few years back. I remember at a particular moment, I'd gone a bit closer to everybody else, turning around, and there was literally 50 people behind me standing like this, and I didn't get what it was initially. Then I realised it was everyone's mobile phone. They were all taking pictures of what was actually happening. So with events like that today, they're being photographed from every angle, images are absolutely everywhere. And also, you've all this kind of face recognition software that's starting to appear, even in consumer-end cameras. We recently bought a Sony HD60 in work, and it's got this kind of cool feature where if I scanned it over the room, as I'm looking through the viewfinder, as it goes by each of you, it's going to drop a little red box in your heads. And then when I look at the video from that, the first thing is an index file that will have a photograph of all you. And then I can click on a bit of the index, and it will bring me to the bit of the tape where you were played. Now, this is a camera that you can buy for, I think it's about €1,000. If you can imagine the sort of stuff that police and military have access to, well, you should imagine it's extremely more sophisticated than that. You have even free software, like iPhoto, for instance, on the Mac, has a face tagging thing in it now. So I basically have been playing around with this. I say, this is a picture of me, this is a picture of me, this is a picture of me. Goes back, looks at the 15,000 pictures I have on my hard drive, and pulls up pictures of me from 20 years ago when I've got entirely different glasses, my hair's pretty different, and I'm obviously 20 years younger. Again, this is stuff that's already really commonly available. So in terms of political police forces, all that sort of stuff, we've got to imagine that what they have is very much more sophisticated. Our problem, is not really individual aspects of technology, but we live in a world that is not the world people lived in 1917, 1936, or indeed the 1970s and the 1980s. And it's the interactive nature, really, of new media that makes the compromises people make in terms of activity, security, and visibility much more visible to us, and we're very much more aware of them. In a lot of ways, that's quite a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing, because nowadays we'd be quite daft to feel we were secure in a lot of contexts where people previously did think they were secure. And I think really, as with previous generations of revolutionaries, it's a question of finding the right approach for each particular set of circumstances. What do you intend to do? What sort of activity do you intend to engage in? And making a set of intelligence choices, basically, on that basis. I.e., if you're going to rob banks, don't have a Facebook page.
Thanks, Andrew. Could I talk next, Robin?
Sure, yeah, sure. I'm just going to tell people that... that we'll probably hear what everybody has to say and then open it up for discussion. So just take note of any questions you want to ask as we go. So, Caroline Campbell?
Hi. I normally do discussions. I think you were at the last minute, which is around kind of open source and Creative Commons and things like that. But I kind of felt I might be preaching a little bit to the converted up here. And also, I was kind of interested, as a person who's not like particularly politically active or anything like that, but I'm very interested in network cultures. I was interested in, I know Andrew has had a substantial web presence for a good few years. I'm interested in how the politically active have presences in social networking sites like Facebook and things like that, because I definitely have difficulties with them. I think, Andy, you've gone through, you've touched on what the problems might be, but I kind of see that there's more, even higher level difficulties with these sites and what they actually represent. I was interested to find out what kind of the balance would be, what you gain, and you obviously gain a lot from people, you know, getting your ideas out there and stuff like that. But what are the negative aspects of it on kind of a micro and a macro level? Now, Emmy, you kind of touched on this just in the introduction. To me, some people think when they look at Google or Facebook or any of these kind of web 2.0 sites, some people actually think that they're public services. Right, which is absolutely amazing, because you will sort of come across people who don't actually see that there might be another motive or agenda behind these things being here. They're not just there for the public good. I don't think, and while there have been recently discussions on privacy and things like that, I don't think people really consider what is going on behind the scenes in these sort of corporations. When I see organisations like Shell to See and things like that with Facebook pages and things like that, I go, oh my God, you're not freaked out that you're so controlled by a corporate entity at the service of profit, and all your membership, everything is up there within this space. For me, it's strange. I guess that you guys have weighed the pros and cons of it. I'm sure you have. But for me, it's what these kind of organisations do is problematic for me. What I think is completely unusual about them is that they change social norms really radically without anyone ever really discussing it. You'll see a bit of a conversation around privacy or something like that, but no one really there's no real discussion about it. Say if there were radical changes being made to privacy like had happened with say with Web 2.0 stuff, it would have gone through say legislative changes and things like that. Instead, corporations decided it with no change. And so, for example, so they can decide how, in the Creative Commons debate, how we'll share music online with an out-of-court settlement in AirComp, that'd be an example of it. Or they can decide how we should have our privacy norms now. I think Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, is pretty much deciding the world's privacy norms, which is a bit strange to me, that there's this one guy who's at the service of profit deciding our privacy norms. Other things I find strange on it is that basically that radical groupings are brought within the monitored space of market and capital. And to me, it could be kind of an argument for how capitalism always recuperates within itself really radical ideas and brings them within its control. So I'd like Andrew to, or maybe someone else here as well, to respond to that later on. Is this just a facet of you being brought within the control of what I see as kind of network capitalism? This is capitalism. These companies work transnationally. They're more powerful than any governments in that they're changing social norms without having to change laws. They're in any country. They've got these huge memberships. And the only time people seem to get radical these days is when, something comes up about something that's happening, like if Facebook is changing its structure or something like that, and the people, people get up and do something then. There's also the argument, I think, that, you know, it's click, you know, the clicking to protest, you know, you do your click, you've done it, and that's you, like, and what happens, you know, afterwards? Does it actually remove the possibility of protest? I was interested in Andrew saying as well, you know, oh, the internet will never be secure. And I know there were attempts like Lockmail and stuff like this to, you know, to create systems that were secure, but like obviously they don't have billions being thrown at them to make them like a working system that people can use. And I just ask Andrew and anyone else as well, like, why should it be the norm that the internet can't be secure? Why shouldn't we be working to having some sort of system where we can exchange ideas without someone snooping on them? You know, why are we just accepting that, oh, you know, it's a given that someone can look at your stuff or a corporation can look at your stuff? I'm going to read a few quotes from a guy called, it's an article which is really interesting. This is a very interesting magazine called Fiber Culture, which kind of looks at these ideas. An article by Gert Loving and Ned Rossenter. A few things, points, I'm just going to throw out there for people to think about. They're not, you know, necessarily structured and coherent structure, but, you know, I'm getting them. He talks about social networks. We initially loved them for their distraction from the torture of now time. Networking sites are social drugs for those in need of the human that is located elsewhere in time or space. It is the pseudo-other that we are connected to, not the radical other or some real other. I'm saying then that the business-minded trust zone has all but eliminated the open, dirty internet forums. I think you're talking about Karen Lincoln was saying that before, that it's all kind of... What he says here, what is created here is a sense of approximation of the social. They're just basically creating another type of labour in which you're constantly at work on, you're constantly on them, and you're all the time being data-mined so that people can create more products for you to consume, basically. Two, it's like you're creating yourself as a consumer-producer on the network. A question I'd like to throw out to people here: what makes a social attractive and socialism so old school and boring? What would be, you know, what is the difference there? One thing I think is particularly interesting is in Facebook you can only have friends, right? So there's no idea of conflict anymore on Facebook. You don't like go on Facebook and say, I'm going to make an enemy of you. I oppose your politics. I oppose what you're saying. And I'm going to interact with you in order to change something. It's all about inclusion, everything being blended down to some kind of homogenous norm. I know there's just some kind of points I'm throwing from out. I don't really have a structured argument on it, but if I get responses from people back, maybe we can open up a discussion on it. I'm a little bit negative, basically, on the social networking. But I'm open to persuasion that it is a good tool and that kind of balances the things that are happening, the dangers that I see with it. Is it?
Do you want to open that up now?
Well, you know, whatever way you want to do it. Like,
does anybody want to respond?
Yeah, communications technology has always been privately owned in many ways. It isn't anything new that Facebook is privately owned either.
But is there any other alternatives to having privately owned communication networks?
I'm somewhat reluctant to come crashing back in after.
No, I just want to know. So I just want to know, and I think maybe the people in the room would know more because you're more whatever.
Okay, can we just put our hands up, and then I think Mark had his hand up first.
I think there is some kind of side projects that aim at actually trying to create a fairly secure online environment for political activity. However, they're not very well developed, and I'm really quite sceptical about how secure such things are. In terms of the trade-off between making activity kind of public, I think for most, I probably speak for most artists in the world involved, but 99% of your activity is public. You know, it's a very minuscule part of your activity that you actually seek to be fairly secure about, and that tends to be around political actions and stuff like that as well. So you wouldn't be using online spaces to be organised certain things, but on the most part, actually what you're trying to make is coherent arguments outside of yourself. So I think there is a trade-off there in terms of what you would use it for, so it's different aspects as well.
Would anybody like to respond to that, or are we taking your comment?
Oh yeah, there's an interesting other quick thing that Gert Loving got. He said, why did indie media never turn into a social networking site?
Well, I mean, social networking sites are basically, the way I see it, they're, you know, Web 1.0, which was like the dot-com era, it's basically an attempt to turn the internet into a giant shopping mall. And it was basically a failure, because that wasn't really quite the internet, what the internet was about when it originally came about. And so Web 2.0 was basically using these theories like 6 degrees of separation as a way of mining data about consumers and using that to make money, because Web 1.0 failed to make money. So I think like indie media wasn't part of that, it wasn't set up to make money, you know. And I think these are basically money making operations.
But you know, if you're seeing that, say, the idea of social networking, like if it's a networking linkage, that's what's interesting about them, and that's why you're using them. So why is it not in a non-commercial context? Like,
because I think basically what happened was that you have very very powerful interests that want to use the internet to make money, and in the 90s they poured funds into the internet. One good thing that came out of that was that it gave internet access to everybody, but it also led to the dot-com crash, right? But in the last decade, they realised they weren't going to make money. Everybody wants to be the next Amazon, and that was never going to happen. So basically, they a lot of very clever people came together, and they realised we can manipulate people's social connections to basically gather information about consumers, to sell products to consumers. That ability to gather information is you know, seen as a gold mine in the business world, and the whole thing was set up for that purpose, and now it's become organized around that purpose. I mean, without that, none of these social networks would exist, none of these online social networks would exist. But the one thing, I don't know, I mean, one theory I have, I think that an interesting occurrence that happens that's worth paying attention to is recently was Google pulling out of China, you know, because the ultimate nightmare outcome of this technology would be a situation where a really repressive government takes all this information and uses it to round up people that they don't like. And that seemed to be what was actually happening in China. The Chinese government basically broke into Google and tried to steal their data. And Google then basically pulled out of China. And the reason they did was because they realised that if the rest of the world saw that happening in China, there could potentially be backlash worldwide against that whole business model. So it was better for them to just pull out. You know, so maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's why, at least at the present time, you won't see this information being used in that way.
Okay. Did you have a slideshow you wanted to?
No, just like a few questions just get going. So that's it. Yeah.
Will we move on?
Yeah.
Maybe
can I just ask you a quick question?
Well, maybe we can come back. Just keep it in mind until afterwards, if that's okay. So, Fionn?
Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit less, even again, than Caroline of an activist. So I guess I'm speaking mostly as somebody who's worked kind of in the online world, as somebody who uses it all the time to get stuff done. How many people in the room have Facebook accounts? So that's 99%. There's maybe two people who can put their hands up. And Twitter, maybe? There's a quarter of people in the room have Twitter accounts. So every day you're sharing information about yourselves, etc. And does anybody here use it to get things done? Do they benefit from it in any way apart from just keeping in touch with people? So again, maybe a quarter, third of the people. So it's obviously very useful for all of us, which is great. I think as a race, you know, anytime we can do something, we'll do it. You know, like if I have a kettle and I have a cup, I'm probably going to make a cup of tea because it's there. You know, it's about the hardware available to me. And it's been great, like in the last... I've grown up a total nerd since I was 14 or 15. Anytime there was some advancement technology that would let me do something else that was kind of nerdily fulfilling but at the same time social, I'll do it. And I'm a sucker for it still today. I'm completely public in a way with my life through my use of Twitter, which maybe I use five or ten times a day. I'll say something on Twitter, which I only kind of, you have to remind yourself sometimes you're not just saying it to the 20 or 50 people or whatever it is you know who are following you, but all of the rest of the people who you don't know. And it's a weird kind of a the notion of privacy to me is almost a little it's not so important for me in a way, because I know I reveal myself online only as much as I consider, as somebody was saying earlier, as much as I know that anybody who's online could, you know, would be able to see it. So that's fine. That's fine with me. I think, like, going back to hardware, it's been great in the last few years because we've had, I mean, look at the hardware that's sitting on this table here. It could do so much. I mean, this hardware alone. And talking about privacy, I mean, I don't know if you ask anyone, could you record this?
Sorry, totally overlooked that.
But you know, I think, like, we know we all have cameras on our phones. This, you know, the next iPhone can take high HD video, and you're going to be able to edit HD video on it as well. Which for me, as somebody involved in filmmaking, is incredible to think about that. You know, film as a medium to communicate ideas and to influence people is now going to be in your hand, like in your pocket. You know, that's incredible. And so, I, you know, in terms of hardware, we're in a very different place than we were 20 years ago, let's say, which is, seems obvious, but you just have to stop and think about how much that's impacted on us. Things like YouTube and Vimeo, yeah, cool, all these people, you know, they have, these corporations have a lot of information about what we're doing and what we're trying to communicate, but at the same time, as a platform to communicate our ideas, it's incredible to have there as a resource. When you look at social networks in terms of publicity or in terms of starting conversations, and it's interesting you said about, like, the whole antagonistic, the non-antagonistic nature of Facebook, but in fact, that's why the pages are there, you know, so it can create an asymmetric relationship. And, you know, Twitter, you know, where a brand doesn't have to be your friend, it can just be your, you can like them, you know. But Twitter also is based on asymmetry where, you know, I might find you interesting, but you might think I'm bored. And that's fine, but I'm interested in you and I'm going to follow you and you're going to let me follow your information. So, you know, I think there is antagonism,
yeah.
But it's, you know, I think it's more based on whoever's ideas speak strongest will be the ones that are most listened to and most permeated. The big problem that I see online, and, you know, in all of my use of it, personal stuff and in terms of work, is actually making, you know, converting that into action. And it's speaking to a room of people who are quite active, is, you know, how do you convert all of this online presence or all this online chatter and activity into actually something changing? And I think, like, an example I'd give, because we were just talking about there earlier, myself and Emily, would be with Playhouse, which was when Liberty Hall was turned into the giant kind of screen or whatever. And we worked with them on a project, and kind of afterwards, like, I live nearby, and it was great to see it every night, apart from the fact that it was incredible to use for a video we did. But I was just thinking, God, it'd be great if they kept it there. So I asked the guy, Tim, who was involved in putting it in, you know, how much would it cost, and what's the how realistic is it to, like, leave it there permanently? And we got this movement running, you know, and it's through a Facebook event page, you know, just one person just set it up and suggested to a few friends, and all of a sudden you have 15,000 people who are like, yeah, save Playhouse, you know, and it's like all over the media and stuff. And, you know, I didn't really do that much for that. I just put a picture on a Facebook page and said, save Playhouse, it's great, you know, and let's see who's into this. And maybe people who are, you know, the powers that be will see that and they'll go, you know, if we did this, people would react well to it, and it's got legs. And it's gone, obviously. So, you know, in a way, that's quite a, it's kind of sad, really, isn't it?
But is that a kind of addictive though of it? Like, you know what I mean? That you've done your clicks to 10,000 people, that say Playhouse.
Well,
right?
It's back to what you say,
yeah.
Click to protest, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when you look at social media, it's great. I think it's great for organising. As somebody who kind of organises people sometimes, as, you know, in terms of clubs or whatever, it's great for organising people, communicating with people, where it comes down to actually getting them to do something beyond something that they actually already want to do.
Mm.
It's not really that. I have yet to see it really coming into itself, you know.
Mm.
And maybe with new technology in terms of stuff that's in your pocket will change a little bit more. The stuff that's coming out online at the moment, like Foursquare, and so that's more location aware, that's a whole new level. I mean, for me, that's the only real privacy that I'm intimidated by. I've tried to live my life not as virtuously, but as happily, you know, as happy with what I do that I would be happy for anyone to know about it as I can be. But I don't want you to know where I am. I don't want you to know that I'm, you know, here or I'm, when I'm at home. And that's kind of the next level of, I think, of privacy that I think is really going to be the challenger. Because you know what, if there's a picture of me on Facebook, you know, doing whatever, then I was there and I was out in a social space and, you know, well, maybe not obviously, but I was okay at the time and having my picture taken and it's got out, big deal. But I don't want you to know where I am. So maybe that's a whole new level of privacy stuff that hasn't even been kind of really done.
And also the things you consider social spaces, like before you'd have to get like a release to go in and film and places and stuff like that. You know, if you're in a bar or something, having a night out.
Yeah.
Now it's just like you're
even with the Foursquare stuff, there's
Foursquare, by the way, it's just like a social network where you actually check in. So I'm sure Seamus Spree is on it. So you'd actually go to, I don't use it, but if you had an iPhone, you'd go and say, I'm checking into Seamus Spree, and you get points for checking into somewhere. So it becomes like almost competitive social network, and you become a mayor of somebody. So if I check in here more than anybody else, I'll become the mayor of Seamus Spree, and how's that for not mayor, you know? But I wonder actually who is the mayor of Seamus Spree. Check that out. But you know, that's a whole new level of privacy stuff, I think. Yeah.
And then like even home security and stuff like that is a major issue with that.
Yeah.
Even though there was a couple of guys who set up, I think it's robmyhouse.com or something like that, and it was just looking for people on Foursquare and on Twitter who have said, just left home.
Yeah. I was talking to my flatmates recently, and I think we have a lot of the same kind of followers and stuff in common, and it's like, I just noticed something, like Dylan was saying, oh, I'm down in my mom's house in Wicklow, and I was like, oh, I'm over in the West, and Una was like, oh, I'm over, you know, we're all, we're just saying we're not home, feel free to drop by,
yeah.
You know, like, so yeah, so but that's again for me. It's more on a personal level than on an organisational level or a political level. I guess that I'm interested in all this territory. But anyway, that's kind of my two cents for the moment.
Great. Can we hear for Carolyn and Fiona? She was never got. Informing people that it was being recorded, but a few people requested that they were really interested, but they couldn't make it. So apologies. So, Vanessa, would you like to go? Or yeah. Angela, would you like to go next?
I have a video clip, does that matter?
Okay, yeah.
Hello now.
Do you want to? I don't mind.
Okay, yeah. I'm just going to talk about the...
We'll like plug you in.
Yeah, sure.
When you come to that, will we do it?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I'll just speak for a second.
Okay.
Then. I'm just going to talk about YouTube and the prevalence and the character of misogyny in new media. It's very broad, so that's why I'm just keeping it to YouTube. And I know YouTube comments are sort of the lowest form of human discourse, but I think that's a good reason to look at them. I looked up... how I got this idea was that I looked up the word feminism in YouTube, and when you type it in, the first clip that comes up, according to relevance, is called Feminism Sucks. And it's a guy going on a very angry rant, which is sort of violently hateful at times and you know, idiotic most of the time, and you know, filled with sort of really vague reference to these crazy statistics that I don't know where he's getting them from. And as ridiculous as all these things are, and like a lot of my friends say to me, you know, there's no point in getting so angry about it. These people are, you know, it's not like they're getting anything published. It's not like they're getting in newspapers. They're not on TV. But they are on something that I look at probably 10 times a day, something that most people look at every day. And I do think that even though they're imitating something that came before, something that's quite old, I think it's worse. I think it's more hateful, it's more violent, and it's totally mainstream. It's right in your face. If you look at the YouTube comments, I'll go into it in a minute, but below pretty much any female who's involved in politics, you don't even have to scroll past the first page to find a reference to, you know, how fuckable she is, basically, is the word that always comes up. It's either, you know, she's ugly, she's hot, you know, something about her cup size, whatever. It's like clockwork every time. And I'm looking at some kind of right-wing and left-wing figures and looking at how incredibly similar the reactions actually are. So I'll just play the clip. It's quite short. It's only about 5 minutes.
So let me just start out talking about that a little bit, because, you know, feminism, from its beginnings, has taken a lot of forms. First, it seemed to be about bra burning. Remember that, Mike, when all the wrong women were burning their bras?
I missed that.
Yeah, that was late 60s. It seemed to be about well, we can do whatever we want sexually. And then it was about the workplace. And now it seems to have got kicking ass. All these movies, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, Charlie's Angels, Xena, Princess Warrior, everyone seems to be kicking a lot of ass. And
well, it was ever so. I mean, there have always been warriors.
So.
You go back to the Amazons, there were generals in the Book of Judges, and general. And go back to the 1960s and 70s, Jane Bond. Those heroines were not especially dangerous.
James Bond?
In the James Bond
book, the galore. If you will.
What's not happening in feminism, the current incarnation on the campus, is not about with females being powerful, it's about victimology. In the typical women's studies course, or if you looked at the website of the Ms. Foundation or the National Organization for Women, it's about women as victims and men as predators and how we're preyed upon by the capitalist, patriarchal, oppressive society.
You go to the vagina monologue.
Exactly. Vagina monologue,
which is, you know,
women are from Venus, men are from hell. Okay, that's the one.
Most women don't call themselves feminists, but a lot still do, even though the goals of feminism have already been accomplished. Feminists say all sorts of crazy things. They say men are pigs, you know, and some even say men are a biological accident. But I don't really care about any of that stuff because it's really just amusing to me. I don't really care about hate groups as long as they don't get too big. That's why the Klan is no longer scary. They're just funny. You know, there's not some big Klan rally in Washington or something. Well, I guess there are the tea parties, but at least we got them to stop wearing the sheets. The KKK went from something that was scary when they had thousands upon thousands of members to something that's just kind of funny. Something you see in, you know, Harold and Kumar escape from Guantanamo Bay. And it's the same thing with feminism. You know, a feminist, you know, some crazy chick with like a pink buzz cut and like army fatigues, you know, she starts talking about, oh, you know, female power and men are scum and all that. You know, it's just funny. It's kind of cute. It's kind of amusing. You just kind of titter at it.
I'd like you to begin by arguing that marriage should be for life. Off you go.
Yes, of course, marriage should be for life. Married life has a logic to it. You marry someone, you make babies with that person, and the more babies that she has, the more that it erodes the parts of her body that make you want to have babies with her. That's the real reason that married couples don't go out. You don't want to sit your wife on a bar stool and then watch it slowly disappear.
I believe that women can be mothers and that that is a respectable career choice, if you want to call it that. I think that's a reasonable thing to do because it is something that you devote your life to. And I think that feminists should be nothing but supportive of the fact that women want to make that decision. And I think they should support the fact that women are able to make that decision. And I also believe that women can make mistakes and that they can take responsibility for other choices that they make. I believe that women can be many of these perpetrators of social ills. There are more than enough statistics showing that women are at least an equal number of domestic violence perpetrators. There are statistics showing beyond a shadow of a doubt that women are the vast majority of child murderers and child abusers. There are statistics showing that a lot of the rape cases in this world are false. And I feel like a lot of that is because women feel like...
I'm sure they'll talk about it and get it straightened out. I don't know if you saw this or not. In an interview last night, Ann Coulter. Do you know much about Ann Coulter?
Well, not too much.
She's apparently a political pundit.
Oh, yes.
Political pundit, yeah. Well, last night she said Bill Clinton is gay.
Yeah.
She mentioned that Bill Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, is gay, and it's a peculiar charge, but it has prompted Bill Clinton to issue this explanation. Take a look.
In an interview this week on CNBC, conservative pundit Ann Coulter claimed that Bill Clinton is a homosexual. And while the former president admits he once told Coulter that he's gay, it was simply a polite excuse to explain why he wasn't hitting on her bony ass. Only gay when it comes to evil, crazy bitches.
Tonight all bets are off.
Okay.
So, like I said, those are all from YouTube, and they weren't that difficult to find. They were all among the top clips that came up on very basic searches, like feminist women, that kind of thing. And I just wrote down some of the clip titles that came up when I searched these words. Feminism Sucks, as I said, was the first one. Vicious Feminism in Schools. Quite a funny one was Sexy College Girl versus Plain Jane Feminist in Miss London University Girl Fight. Stupid Cleaning Women, which was a compilation of the brat's house cleaner falling and doing things incorrectly. Porn Prevents Rape. Understanding Rape Statistics, which is very interesting. It suggested that more women try to wrongfully accuse men of rape than are raped. It was quite a strange one. Feminist Reprogram Sexy Japanese Android Girl. which was actually, I gather, it was a robot where they chose, sort of like Lisa Lionheart, they chose to make the robot say things about the weather and just scientific facts rather than saying something cutesy, which she had been doing before and sort of infantile. There are also some websites that I came across. There's falserapesociety.blogspot.com. There's antifeminist.com. There's one called menarebetterthanwomen.com, who you can donate on the site, and they put up enormous billboards, and they put their stickers on, like they had a picture of a sticker, a Men Are Better Than Women sticker on an Amelia Earhart monument, you know. But they put up these huge billboards and everything, and they have forums which are called things like Why All Women Hate Sex, which is right next to a forum called Why All Women Are Cheating Whores. there's another one called Jermaine Greer is a Cunt. But it's pretty awful, and I think the guy who runs it kind of became famous because he went on Dr. Phil once. And so I guess because he's a celebrity and because he wants to, well, a celebrity of sorts, and he wants to keep things going, he's not quite as explicit as the people who are commenting on it. The people who are commenting on it, I mean, I've gone in a couple of times under kind of gender-neutral names, and the people who comment on it are just, I mean, the things they say are just absolutely incredible, you know. They're as vicious, but I guess less witty than that comedian who said that, told that absolutely awful joke about getting married. After I heard that joke, I think I was sort of in a daze for about a week after it. I thought it was absolutely shocking. I've never been able to retell the story because I can't actually say what he said. I just think it's appalling. And you can imagine how women in the audience must have felt, especially maybe pregnant women or women who had several kids, to see that everyone around them was laughing and clapping, you know. But the really interesting thing about the tone that they use is that, like, you know, Kevin Myers, like Glenn Beck, like any of these people who use this paranoid style, it kind of suggests that they're saying something very edgy and that they're being really challenging. And I think that they also kind of use the style, ironically, of alternative comedians in the Thatcher era, you know, who were actually saying something edgy. And these guys, like Russell Brand or whoever, you know, they're big celebrities, and they're talking down to these groups, you know, and they think they're being edgy because they're talking about women and ethnic minorities, and, you know, they're really pushing those boundaries. And also, one of the terrible things that pops up an awful lot on YouTube and on YouTube comments is this idea that feminists have nothing to complain about because they have already achieved everything, and even some women, as you saw, will go on and say, what's all the complaining about? And just to put that in a bit of perspective, and if anybody wants to ask me about any of these statistics afterwards, because I know feminists have often been accused of being manipulative with statistics, I brought everything with me so I can give you proof if you want. But women do 2/3 of the world's work and earn 10% of the world's income. 2/3 of the world's illiterate people are women. 99% of the means of production globally is owned by men. The rape conviction in Ireland is 7%. The representation in Parliament is 13%. Of course, we don't have the right to legal abortion. Our constitution is very sexist in the most literal terms. I don't know what else to say. I think that's as bad as it gets, really. One statistic that came up in a very good book called The Equality Illusion was in the UK during the 1990s, the number of men paying for sex doubled, and the rates of post-traumatic stress disorder among prostitutes is roughly the same as that of rape and state-imposed torture, which is 68%. And when you put those two things beside each other, it's pretty grim. I know I've been sort of very gloomy about YouTube and about this supposedly very democratic thing where everyone gets to have their say, but I think that even though there isn't an editor exactly, there is such a level of bullying going on in it that it is regulating itself in that way, and the most insulting kind of puerile people are the ones that are regulating it. So, you know, it's even worse than, you know, the editor of the Sunday Independent or whatever. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, I looked up Ann Coulter. Could you just put your hand up if you know anything about Ann Coulter, if you know her? Okay. So I looked up Naomi Klein and I looked up Ann Coulter and I looked at the first five clips that came up. When I looked up Naomi Klein, like I say, most of the time I didn't even have to scroll past the first page of comments. They were straight into, she's hot, no she's not. So for the first one, somebody said, this woman is pretty dumb. This is about Naomi Klein. They were debates and news appearances. She's pretty hot, so I survived the 8 minutes of this nonsense. This woman is a stupid cunt. She's not even cute. She's a bimbo. I want to fuck her. Opposites attract, I guess. And the last one was, lol, Klein is getting fat as shit. So then I looked at Ann Coulter, and I know the reason I looked at Ann Coulter and the reason that I put her on that was because I also thought I'd be preaching to the converted on everything. And Ann Coulter, if any of you don't know, is pro-racial profiling. She's against gay marriage. She's pretty awful politically. But I grudgingly have to say that she is a very good debater. She's incredibly sharp-witted. You absolutely couldn't say she's stupid. You could say she's crazy, she's right-wing, she's awful. But you can't say she's stupid. She absolutely floored Jeremy Paxman one night on Newsnight. I've never seen anything like it. You can see it on YouTube. And actually, it was one of the clips that I looked at. But the first five came up with these. In the first, she was called a Republican hooker, a retarded bitch, a cunt, and a dumb bitch. In the second one, somebody said, described her as a whore that looks like Ted Danson on crack. In the next one, somebody called her Anhole Cunter. And somebody even said, she's a cunting cunt. Another person said, I'm a little curious why a 50-plus anorexic-looking woman is dressed like a goth, oversexed 16-year-old. Another person said, I thought about it carefully. I think I'd bang her. So they're very similar, you know, and whether it's supposed to be a compliment or not, it's always an insult, you know. It's always, these women's opinions don't matter. And when you look at parliamentary representation or even the figures of women among left-wing groups, like, as we all know, they're a lot smaller. And one excuse that men often make, or people who disagree with feminism often make, is that women don't vote for women, and that women are not confident enough, not putting themselves forward, you know, and so it's their own fault that they're not being represented politically. But if you look at this, and you look at this is the context, this is what women are looking at every day, it's actually a totally rational thing to decide, if I appear in public, if I express a political opinion in public, I'm going to be judged for my weight, and even if the person, you know, and how I look in general, my clothes, my hair. It was the same with Sarah Palin. Again, as much as I hate the woman, I think that everyone who is a feminist should really think about the fact that, you know, women throughout the political spectrum all encounter this, and, you know, they're being cut out at every level. And that the next time, you know, a woman who is centrist or who is on the right, who you don't like, is being mocked for not being pretty enough, you should never partake in it, never clap, never laugh, because the same kinds of people will do the same thing to you if you happen to be on the other side of the political spectrum to them. And I think that's something that all feminists who are also anti-capitalists should always bear in mind. I think that's more or less all I wanted to say.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Do you think that, like, the fact that all of these opinions can be expressed in reaction to these videos, do you think that proves that the internet is pro-democracy, because everyone's going to have their say, but at the same time, they will never actually be, you know, put on a platform where there'll be lots of people listening to them, because obviously it's all a load of rubbish.
Mm.
So they'll get to say it and they'll get to feel like they've had their say, but their, you know, their idea, or, you know, obviously it's so puerile, their idea or their point will never mean anything to anybody. I mean, it's just a trash can of commentary.
You know, there are websites, plenty of them, where kind of racist websites where people deny the Holocaust. You know, and you know, they
deny the Holocaust in real life as well. Do you know what I mean? It's just a mirror of society. You know.
Well, so. I think they do it more online because it's anonymous and they can get away with it.
Mm.
I'm sure, you know, if they work with people from different parts of the world, they're probably going to be a bit less courageous than if they're just an anonymous person online. And certainly this stuff, I mean, it's just totally colonized this space, you know. When I looked up feminism, you know, there was almost no... The only feminist on there in the first 20 or so clips that I looked up was Naomi Wolf, and she's very moderate, you know. And even at that, I mean, I think it was a clip for the Feminist Majority or something like that. It was...
IG.
Hmm?
Is it Ali G?
Well, yeah, there was that, but there was also a clip of her talking about other things. But as for democracy, I mean, I think, like I said, I think it is regulated because there's so much, you know, it's so vicious, and it's regulated by the viciousness, basically. It's democratic in the sense that anyone can go on and say anything. But what I was going to say about the Holocaust denial is, you know, if somebody goes on and says the Holocaust never happened, you know, and they manage to have like 5 misspellings and sentences, you know, it's just totally ridiculous, and they don't really put their point across very well. One way of looking at it is, well, this doesn't really matter. But another way is, well, if they say this enough times, no matter how stupidly they put it across, you know what I mean? It's almost as if people who want to state the obvious have to, you know, people who you actually have to explain, you know, here's some of the evidence to say that the Holocaust did happen, you know, whereas you might not have to say that if it weren't for the fact that this is happening so often.
Do you think there should be more editorial control then in terms of
I kind of apologize about being a bit gloomy about this is because I really don't know what you can do. I mean, I don't think editorial control is the way, but I do think that on this particular issue, I guess women just have to be more vocal and
report
content as offensive.
That's what, whenever I see those groups on Facebook, you know, the hate groups of people I know, or stuff like, you know, like Ups and everything, that, you know, always just use, you gotta like act with your...
You've been listening to a recording of a RAG meeting on new media and social media. That was part one of the meeting. There's another speaker to come and some discussion that follows. The recording was made and edited by Andrew Flood for Indie Media Ireland and for the WSM website, www.wsm.ie.